You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the RSA. My name's Georgina Chatfield. I'm Programme Manager for RSA Academies, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this very special lunchtime talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Professor Jennifer Jacquet. Jennifer Jacquet is an assistant professor at the Department of Environmental Studies at New York University. Jennifer works at the intersection of conservation and cooperation. She formerly wrote the Guilty Planet blog at Scientific American, contributes to Edge.org, and she conceived of the modernised Shame Totem Pole in 2011 at the Serpentine Gallery here in London. She joins us today to share her radical insights on shame as a positive tool for social change. In her new book, Is Shame Necessary?, Jennifer argues that if we want to make large-scale changes, we need to become active citizens, ready to find creative ways to shame those who have the power to bring about change, but are not doing so. So, Jennifer, we're delighted that you've been able to join us to share some of your thinking. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Jennifer Jacquet.
Thanks a lot. The title of the book is Shame Necessary, and I think most of us have intimate experiences with shame. In the book, I have a little line that friends have constantly emailed me about, that saying that the book is not about this personal feeling of deep shame, like you might feel if your father brought home an inflatable sofa. Trust me. And I don't know how many of you have ever sat on an inflatable sofa or been even near one. But this moment in the book that I just sort of brush over, in which everyone said, what are you talking about exactly? Because people love to dig into your personal feelings of shame, is about sort of the deep feelings of shame that prevent us from making close personal relationships or prevent us from leaving the house and maybe have nothing to do with social exposure at all. It's sort of just about feeling like things are going really wrong. And this inflatable sofa, just to give you the backstory, was something my father purchased as his main sofa. I mean, there was no other sofa in the house when he and my mom separated. They were planning on getting divorced. They actually didn't get divorced in the end. But when I went to visit him in his new apartment and saw this inflatable sofa, I just had this feeling that, like, everything was over. Wound up being okay in the end. So again, this is not about the shame that prevented Jonathan Franzen from writing his novel because he felt like writing autobiographical sentences made him want to take a shower. It's more about the shame implied with social exposure. And sometimes it's done by governments. This is a case in China where the Chinese government is carting around prostitutes, and you can actually see very well the shame display. A universal display in humans, covering the face, trying to make the body small. But it's not just about this kind of shame, which I think we can all agree makes us feel a bit uncomfortable. It's about this kind of shame. So now Republicans in the U.S. saying they finally back climate action. This is the citizenry. And yet we have a lot of climate denialists in our U.S. Congress, as some of you might know. And so now there's a whole platform that the Organizing for Action, the sort of NGO arm of Obama, has organized, where you can actually call out on Twitter and email individuals within Congress who are denying climate change. It's about this kind of shame, where Greenpeace flies a blimp over the Koch Industries headquarters to expose their funding of anti-climate legislation. This kind of shame, where Rainforest Action Network has gone after 9 banks that are funding mountaintop removal in Appalachia. And then I want to turn really quickly to another painful emotion, just to get it out of the room, which is guilt. And I have my own personal reasons for feeling guilty, and psychologists say that guilt is a lot better than shame. In fact, they argue that guilt leads to reparation more easily than shame, and it takes on an action sort of about yourself rather than your whole self, so you can often make apologies. But there are arguments that actually guilt is a rather new emotion on the emotional stage. Shakespeare used the word guilt only 33 times in his plays, and he used the word shame 344 times. Also, in certain Eastern cultures, there's no word for guilt. There's only words that mean shame or translate to shame. So this is really interesting that though it's supposedly a more healthy emotion, it doesn't seem to be a universal one. Although studies on Westerners, especially one in the Netherlands, found that people on average feel guilty for about 2 hours a day. So we all know, like, hey, it's real. It's real for me. But the question is sort of how to delineate it properly from shame. And I can remember really well my first feeling of guilt, which has continued in this vein, and this is just a more recent headline, about what humans were doing to the planet. So this was, I read headlines like this, and I feel, I'm pretty sure I would nail it down as guilt. Or this kind of headline where chickens are killed in inhumane ways. But the very first time was for me in reading this book that I had when I was 8 years old. And I wrote to some organizations in the back of the book. And one of the organizations, the Earth Island Institute, sent me in response a photograph that left me totally floored. It was the first time that I felt guilty for the way humans were treating other animals. And it was on the basis of a campaign that sent this man, Sam Labuddy, undercover on board tuna fishing vessels off of Mexico. And he managed to capture what we knew had gone on for years, but what we didn't have visual evidence for, which was the slaughter of dolphins in tuna fishing gears. So when I was 9 years old, I get this letter, I open it up, and I see these black and white photographs from that campaign of dolphins being killed on board a tuna vessel. And I demanded that immediately that we boycott tuna. We could never eat tuna again, I told my mom. She agreed, and there was an actual widespread boycott in the UK as well to end basically the consumption of tuna until this problem was sorted out. And then in 1990, just actually like not even a year later, this little label was introduced, the Dolphin Safe label. And my mom explained to me, look, there's this new thing. It's safe now. We can eat it. And I use this to illustrate the beginning of the book and an example of what I think was a major pivotal point in history, which is that the shift from changing suppliers, that the focus of changing suppliers shifted to the focus of changing demand, and that individuals were made to feel like they were part of the problem, which was certainly true, but also that they could be part of the solution if they changed what they bought. And this is also intuitively very true, right? So the shift from changing the way the fishermen fished the tuna to changing the way that we consumed it, and then that would automatically have an effect on the way they caught the tuna if demand demanded it. And so Dolphin Safe logo was one of the first, along with organic logos, but now there have been a slew of these types of campaigns. The Forest Stewardship Council, cruelty-free, carbon-neutral, bird-friendly, rainforest-friendly, grass-fed, the Marine Stewardship Council. And what all of these tools together, fair trade, did, in analyzing this, I really think that it wasn't necessarily strategic, but as a result of this kind of work, it re-engaged a minority that might have been really sort of active as citizens and as people demanding legislation that would sort of cover an entire industry, to re-engaging that minority as consumers, as people that could make a difference primarily through what they choose to buy. And the problem with any of these types of labels is that none of these represent more than 10% of the marketplace, with the exception of Dolphin Safe Tuna, which actually is very widespread and has actually had a difference, not just because of the label, but there was actually lots of legislation that came with it. So my argument is that the people who really care about these issues, and I'm not sure it will ever be more than 50% of the population, but that they were encouraged to not worry about so much the broader impacts, but to worry about their own consumption habits. And they were made to feel this way and encouraged to alleviate their feeling of guilt that they had by engaging as consumers. And so my main argument in the book is that guilt has come to eclipse shame. Whereas in previous social movements, I mean, if you said during the attempt to abolish slavery that, yeah, it's fine, you don't have to own a slave. If you don't want to, don't own a slave. But if everyone else wants to, you know, they can, and we'll let the market decide. This was not an appropriate blanket response to slavery, or eventually became not one. I mean, it's funny, you can sort of see how the morality around the issue changed, because at first it said, well, you can move north, or... Anyway, a more relevant issue in the case of, I think, products and in this case, labor abuses, was Cesar Chavez's widespread boycott of table grapes in California to try to get higher wages for migrant workers. And I think if you said to Cesar Chavez, what we're going to do is introduce a label for grapes that say these grapes were picked by workers who made a fair wage, and we're going to allow the market to decide, and the people who want to buy these grapes will, and those workers on those farms will be paid a fair wage, and the people who don't want to buy that will continue buying the same old grapes. And Cesar Chavez would not have found this acceptable. He wanted to raise the standard everywhere. And yet we have allowed, through these types of labels, to agree that the majority of industry can keep on behaving as they would like, and the part of industry that changes and caters to these consumers will be wind up being sort of less than 10%. So I would argue throughout the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, guilt came to eclipse shame as a tool, because previously a lot of the focus was on changing, using crowds to shame industries to get them to change and incite legislation, again, that would affect everyone. And there's a point here where I think I should distinguish really quickly between what is shame and what is shaming. Shame is obviously an emotion, the one that we're familiar with. It's a universal emotion. It probably evolved as a signal to submission, to dominance hierarchy. Even Darwin was so interested in shame and marveled at why even the blind blush, because how do you have this response without having people who are blind from birth, as it turned out? Shame can also increase stress. So one thing that I have become really skeptical of is, when do we think people feel ashamed? So researchers, psychologists will tell you we can only know that by measuring cortisol response, because every other indicator can easily be faked. You can say you feel ashamed, but you don't. You can show a shame posture, but you don't. So these are really, you know, if you're in psychology, the whole question of feeling shame, you have to sort of say on what grounds you think that someone feels it. And Darwin also described shame as thinking what others think of us. So again, this comes back to this idea of requiring an audience, linking somehow to reputation. But, and this is, these are state shaming campaigns. So of course, early in history, the stocks, the pillory, the whipping pole. But this is, in the U.S., more recent ones where you're asked to hold a sign for stealing outside of Walmart, or a judge in my home state of Ohio making this woman carry this sign because she drove around a school bus on the sidewalk. What's interesting also is, even though she kind of has the shame display by hiding her eyes, you know, and her identity, doesn't want to really be doing what she's doing there. But the key thing is that this is just one little slice of shaming. There's plenty of shaming that happens on the internet that's not at all linked to the state, right, where the crowd actually comes in and is trying to issue public opprobrium. And how you feel about all these cases of shaming matters. So I don't necessarily endorse any of these cases, but how we actually feel matters, because shaming, that's kind of part of it, is that it requires an audience. And so if you as an audience don't feel comfortable with it or disagree with it, that makes shaming less powerful. And in fact, legal scholars have argued against shaming punishments on the grounds of protecting the audience more so than the victim. That we say we want a democratic justice system. We want due process. We want to alleviate ourselves of the impulse to punish. And we would therefore like the state to play that role rather than the crowd. And that's why also you see a lot of coverage online about the dangers of mob justice and public shaming on Twitter and in newspapers. And again, that's in part because not all shaming then is like all other shaming. And I think we should avoid painting all shaming with this really broad brush to say all shaming is bad. And I hope to show you some cases that might challenge sort of that instinctive impulse. So in online shaming, there's no doubt that it really tends to go after, in the sort of Twitter sphere, that kind of buzz that you're hearing a lot of about these days, and it attacks individuals. The punishment is disproportionate. And in fact, I would argue that that's most of our discomfort, is that the punishment often far outweighs the crime being often a politically incorrect statement on Twitter, right? Like not even a real... nothing in real sort of physical space. There's no due process online, and it's carried out, again, by the crowds rather than the court. So all of this makes it feel a little bit like the town square, but kind of worse than the town square, because it doesn't go away the next week. It's still searchable, it's still shareable, and it still will be even a year from now. But again, I would argue that the online... sort of Twitter argument is a common and a problematic but also a sort of narrow view of shame. Because maybe something like this makes you feel less uncomfortable if certain towns in Britain are singled out as having the worst water pollution, if certain companies are singled out for behaving the worst in terms of palm oil plantations and rainforest destruction. And so, again, I just want to emphasize that I think all shaming cannot be painted with the same broad brush. And here's some evidence of some of shaming's recent success. So a film came out in the States called Blackfish, which a documentary film about the sort of welfare issues around keeping orca whales at SeaWorld. And there was then a big grassroots campaign that followed. This, again, is not led by the government. It's entirely led by the crowds. A lot of it is actually just happening online. And here is the Washington Post tracking the stock value of SeaWorld since the film came out. Its stock value has plummeted 60%. Its revenues are down 7%. Attendance is down 5%. Southwest Airlines, which even painted its planes, you know, like orca whales, ended its 25-year partnership as a result of social disapproval. Nothing to do, again, with legislation. Yet, now there are some major court cases being filed. Or you could argue that this was a shaming map put out by several different human rights organizations, highlighting in 2004 the countries that remained around the world that still executed juvenile offenders. And apparently this map was very influential in the Supreme Court's decision in 2005 to overturn the legislation that allowed the execution of juvenile offenders. So the Supreme Court outlawed it in 2005. And again, also the types of countries, Yemen, Iraq, Nigeria, who were alongside the U.S., apparently these were not the best company to keep on the global stage. And I think it's no surprise that President Obama is going to pursue a name and shame approach in the Paris Accord in November, talking about climate change, because on the one hand, at the international level, there are not a lot of options for other forms of formal punishment. Reputation at that international scale is one of our main drivers of changing behavior. And also because he knows that he probably won't get a formal agreement passed through Congress. So this is something he can do based on presidential authority, using the power of reputation rather than formal sanctions. It may not be ideal, but the question is, what else do we have? And then there's lots of interesting and cool research on shame, and a lot of this tends toward individuals rather than corporations or institutions. But I just want to share some of it with you now. Research showing that actually shaming and dirty looks have mattered to reduce smoking as much as taxes on cigarettes. Really interesting experiments threatening to expose in certain towns in the U.S. the names of people who will do vote in the election, and then in another group of people, the names of people who do not vote. And in this experiment, both actually shame and honor mobilized voting, but only shame mobilized people who were not as likely to vote. So again, it depends on sort of what the problem is and who you're most interested in, and whether or not you feel like it's acceptable to go after individuals at all. And then an experiment my colleagues and I did also on shame and honor, looking at how social exposure, the threat of social exposure, affects cooperation. And so in a cooperative game setting where students could give or not give money to a public pool that was doubled and redistributed to others, both shame and honor, the threat of it, and then we actually followed through after 10 rounds of the game, led to increased cooperation by about 50%. So you're going to say, well, you just said honor worked in voting, and you said honor worked in your experiment, so why are we giving a talk about shame? We could all feel better if you would talk about honor. But here's a case by the state of California where they single out the top 500 tax delinquents in the state. You have to owe more than $100,000. And then they still only look at the top 500. They've been doing this since 2007. They've gotten over $400 million in back taxes as a result of this campaign, which is done by the state. And you ask yourself, how could they use honor in the same way? To honor the 92% of people who do pay their state taxes, it's just not really an option. And also, I should say that this program only costs about $100,000 a year to run, and that they do actually target individuals, and actually individuals within the tax system at the state level have a greater impact than corporations. Also, really, really important, the threat of shame is more important and more effective than the shame itself. So the key period is the 6 months before their name is listed online. That's when they might pay their taxes. Once they're already on the list, it's much harder. And this is what we found in our experiments too, is once you have a bad reputation, it's very hard to convince anyone to improve it. So the idea is to not allow it to be eroded to begin with. Oh, so here's right now on the list, the top individual owes more than $6 million in delinquent taxes. In the case of, and that's the other thing, in why not use honor with climate change, again, the countries who are not producing emissions, like if we want to honor Fiji, I just think it's not going to make as big of a difference to the climate debate as going after China, the U.S., and India. This is a collective action problem. So often the worst players in the game, in this case, a really serious game, matter more to us than the most cooperative players. So that is just to say that, again, the nature of the problem matters as to whether or not you turn to social disapproval. And I would argue problems that are more social in nature are more amenable to social disapproval. So this is another, this is an example of an app that you can use to alert your friends and your social network if you press the snooze button too many times in the morning. So I would argue this is a misuse of shaming and social disapproval, because I don't care if you oversleep. It has nothing to do with me. But it's trying to tap into what they know is the power of being watched, the changing your behavior under the microscope. And so a problem like vaccinations, which in the U.S. has been just a real issue lately, it's no surprise that during this the whole measles outbreak, there was lots of talk about turning to shame and social disapproval, because this problem is much more social in nature, I would argue, than the snooze button. So that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. That was fascinating. And having read the book, there's an awful lot of studies that you've spoken about and exams spoken about in the presentation. So a lot of that was ringing true to things that that I've read. You mentioned in the talk that shaming has to be specifically applied. Is it possible to shame someone who doesn't feel a sense of social disapproval?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the argument and why I kind of put whether or not people feel anything aside. Because I would say, there are certain, you can argue almost that SeaWorld, does it feel anything? Mm. It's unlikely SeaWorld feels anything at all. It's an institution. And yet it responds to social disapproval. And so I think that there are institutions and individuals who are shameless, and often that's because they're insulated in really interesting ways from, let's say, for instance, private companies actually wind up being more insulated than public companies, or banks that don't have a retail arm. I was just talking about this with a friend yesterday. Barclays actually gets targeted because it has this consumer familiarity, whereas, a bank that doesn't have a consumer or retailer arm is more immune from the social pressure. So it's interesting that sort of brands, they get both the positive and the negative side of, and certainly with individuals, that can be true too. If you're a super wealthy individual, you might care less about sort of public opprobrium.
Yeah, sure.
And if you're super poor, there's a legal scholar who says that, being poor insulates you because you can't fall further sort of on the economic rung, and being wealthy insulates you because
you've probably got more money.
You're not really worried about really having a job.
Yeah, sure. And you mentioned climate change on a number of occasions. We had an event here earlier in the week called Youth Voices on Climate Change, and we heard from a number of young people. And there was one young activist openly said that she'd decided to stop feeling guilty about small-ish things like drinking from bottled water, taking the occasional flight, and she was instead going to put her energies and her efforts into the climate change fight elsewhere. And I just wondered whether, because she said that, and it was quite refreshing to hear it out loud from an activist, if you felt that given the relationship between guilt and shame that you've spoken about, whether there's a message in there for us as individuals when it comes to thinking about how we respond to climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I am one of those individuals who feels really guilty about the problem and who feels guilty about what I do every day. I mean, and how do we combat that? And one of the things is that sometimes I do feel like that guilt is used almost in a judo style where people say to you, you're not allowed to criticize the problem unless you're part of the solution. So unless I'm sort of bicycling to work every day. Yeah. But if I live in Los Angeles, for instance, what are my options, really, to engage in a really systematic and sustainable way? There's no public transportation, no bike lanes, you know what I mean? Mm. So in a sense, I'm not saying that lets the individual off the hook, but I do think the individual then, let's say, attacking the issue of public transportation is more important than changing his or her light bulb. Mm. In some sense, the system itself, and those are the types of solutions that scale. Mm.
What felt quite healthy almost about this girl saying how she felt about her guilt was it was like she was putting her guilt over there, and because she'd done that, she could then focus on politically engaging in climate change, and whereas you can get quite wrapped up, as you were saying, about it being a human emotion and quite consuming if you dwell on it.
Well, and
you
also
then do nothing. There's inertia as a result.
It's very personal. So even the whole aspect of guilt where it's an internal conversation and it links back to you as an individual. Mm. Therefore, it's a much better friend of sort of the consumer solutions because it's about you as an individual.
Yeah.
To put your guilt on the side, then you say, I'm willing to think about the entire system and how I am just one individual within this bigger system and actually go, I think that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Brilliant. A different kind of a question now. At the RSA, we've got a mission that we're working on called the Power to Create, whereby we mean that people have within themselves the power to create ideas or interventions that can affect social change. From the research that you've done, what have been the most creative and effective shaming tactics
okay,
that you could
I'm
share
so
with
glad
us?
Glad you asked that. Yeah, because I had a slide of Antonis Machus, who I use as the sort of this is a man who really understood the art of shaming, and he was the mayor of Bogota.
Right.
He also understood the art of shamelessness, I will say, because he was the president of the university. He was a philosopher by training and a mathematician, I think. And in trying to get his student body's attention one evening, he mooned them.
Oh.
And so they were quiet, but the next day he lost his job. And based on that attention that he was able to get through that act of shamelessness, he became the mayor of Bogota. He ran the cheapest election ever, and people sort of said, who is this guy, and what's he up to? And he would wind up using throughout his two terms, actually, shame and shamelessness as in this really artful and way that the crowd really accepted to improve human behavior around the city. So one of his most examples he's most famous for, and really they were able to show had a big effect, was they had trouble with high fatalities due to traffic accidents. So originally he hired something like 20 mimes, and then he wound up hiring 400 more. So 420 mimes spread out around Bogota who were asked to follow and mimic and ridicule bad drivers and pedestrians crossing at the wrong time. And it was embraced like the sort of street theater element, but really took on a real and serious problem. And they were able to show the decline in traffic accidents as a result of this. And again, without anyone sort of feeling like he'd attacked their human dignity or that, you know, the sort of that China shaming example.
Yeah.
Yet these belong in the same category somehow. And they're so different and we feel so differently about them, which is why I think it's just interesting to think through a few examples like that. I also love examples of, because we operate in this attention economy, and Machus was obviously doing a very real life, not online campaign. But the whole use of sort of concealed irony for shaming. I know NPR on April Fool's Day last year, the public radio in the U.S., you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
yeah, they ran this headline that was like, Americans don't read anymore. And then if you read the piece, it said, please don't share or tweet because we're actually trying to see how many people just read the headlines. And so it was this sort of act of like, self-shaming. So many people wound up sharing it, liking it, and then basically they hoisted themselves on their own petards because of the concealed irony of the NPR piece.
Brilliant. Okay, if we open up to the audience now, we've got a couple of roving mics either side, and we'll probably take two at a time.
Great.
Thank you, that's very, very interesting. I just want to bring up the question of the difference between guilt and shame, first of all. Obviously, it involves morality as well. A lot of people don't feel guilty about certain things where we feel they should feel guilty about because they don't have morals or they don't believe in the general good. So it's very difficult to shame someone like that because they don't feel guilty. And the word shame is what you do to someone else, but guilt is something you feel. So you can't force someone to feel guilty. And in the same way that climate change deniers often feel that they don't agree with the evidence, obviously the evidence is overwhelming, they don't agree with it. It may be because they are involved in the oil industry or something, but it may be simply that they don't like scientists or something stupid like that. Very difficult to shame them. So the idea that you can shame people who are entrenched in a particular idea, I don't know whether you've discovered this, but it is hard. But in general, I think what you say is terrific. But I just want you to comment on that. But one other thing about shameless. When you say someone is shameless, this goes back to what I was saying before. They're shameless because they don't feel they have no idea what the common good is, which is linked to morality. Therefore, it doesn't matter to them if they do something nasty or do something like drop litter. They don't care.
Okay.
So comment on that, please.
Lovely. And we take the gentleman behind,
is it? Isn't there a danger in that there's a very fine line between public shaming on the one hand and mob rule on the other? So the victim there's no due process. The crowd might simply get it wrong. They might vilify an alleged murderer who turns out to be completely innocent. Mm-hmm. So how do you cope with that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that's the danger of having all of these new digital technologies, this new audience of 2.7 billion people, the possibility of mob rule online, I would argue, is almost bigger than in real life. On the other hand, when the state is failing to intervene on a serious social issue, or when there's no possibility of state intervention, I would argue that turning to shame is sort of the natural thing for the crowd to do. And I would not say that it should turn to shame when there's the option of formal punishment that's available. So there are cases I draw out in the book of people who have taken people to court who they've also caught on film doing something, and then they also post that online. So the people wind up having the sort of formal punishment of a fine or imprisonment, and they get the social opprobrium. And that feels to me like a misuse of our attention, and also because shaming is so fickle, because it's so dangerous, I don't see the point for that. So one of the sort of things I say in the book is that no system of formal punishment should be available, in fact. But when you have the issue like of mistreatment of orca whales at SeaWorld, which is actually not illegal, so there's no way that they can actually take SeaWorld to court, how do they, but yet there's this feeling that what is happening is wrong, in the same way with the banker bonuses. It wasn't illegal, but it was sort of, people said it was morally wrong after the financial crisis. That's when people say, okay, then we're turning to the court of social disapproval. And do I think that that's the right way to go? I mean, ideally, we would all have the access to due process and to, I think, proportional punishment. But I think in these, sometimes there are cases where it's inevitable that social approval, and because we're all being asked to be part of something like this every day, I think it's worth thinking through the kind of issues we really want to lend our attention to. As to your question about sort of guilt and shame and people who are shameless don't feel guilt, for instance, my own experiments really lead me to doubt that, in the sense that we had a game where all the players were anonymous, and we just let them play. And then when we introduced the threat of shame, so after 10 rounds, we're going to expose the 2 out of the 6 of you who are least generous, we see a bump in 50% cooperation. I would argue, based on the number of students we ran through, people probably felt guilty or not guilty or as socially concerned as everyone else, and yet this threat of exposure, not real punishment, just exposure in front of their peers, led them to change their behavior. So is it the perfect regulator? No. I mean, I think the reason we have harsher forms of punishment is because shame is not the perfect tool. It's, you know, we have physical punishment. We have prison, which in some ways are harsher or could be. But I think that shame is still one form of social regulation that clearly does work, but maybe, again, not to that 100% degree.
I'm just thinking about the individual and the corporate, basically. So, meaning corporate for any large organisation, politicians, or whoever you like, teams.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the emotional reaction of shaming in an individual, so you see it, say, in politicians who don't resign, and then a critical mass is reached when clearly the conversation goes on with their boss who says, no more, you can't carry on, it's bringing shame upon us all. In comparison to how an organisation reacts, was interesting, you know, you showed the statistics of the drop in SeaWorld's market worth, which was seemed from the graph to be more profound than the drop in attendance.
Mm-hmm.
So it's what's interesting to me, and I wondered what you might say about the difference, because an organisation doesn't have any feelings. It doesn't have feelings, and it's interesting to me that the same word is being used. While you might shame the supposed murderer,
Yeah. You
cannot shame an organisation. What you do is make its stock drop. I mean, literally, that's all we can do in the market economy, and I'm interested in that, using the same word, but it actually being a profoundly different thing, or is it not?
Yeah,
lovely. We'll just take one more.
Thank you for the talk. In terms of stemming and linking with the comments, it makes me think about the psychopath brain and how more and more, I don't know if you understand about the psychopath brain, but if more and more people in large institutions enroll people with psychopath brain, how would that then allow us to make a difference or make a change in what the lady was talking about in terms of making them feel that shame, and how if more and more of society who grow with maybe neglect and are not touched in this way to look at the common good or morality, then how could we then target that? I don't know if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so some of you may have seen this study in Nature late last year just December or January, showing how if you prime, in their case, I think it was Swiss bankers, professional identities, they're more dishonest. But if you prime their at-home identities, if you get them to thinking how they are with their families, they're as honest as teachers and firemen and other sectors. And yet these other sectors, when you prime their professional identities, they are also as honest as they are at home. And the criticism, of course, is of the culture then of the banking sector in this case. But I imagine there are lots of other sectors you could look at. And so the argument about the psychopathic brain and psychopaths being drawn to corporations, I realize this is an outdated analogy, but it does feel a little chicken and egg in the sense that it's not clear, actually, to me, that it's not the institution's culture that's leading to the kind of behavior that we see. And so, I came across so many examples of this researching the book that, you know, bankers, they didn't feel... One of the threats was, we're going to publish the banker bonuses online. And the bank said, you actually probably shouldn't do that because it'll just make the bankers jealous of one another, that somebody got a bigger bonus than they would. You know, the culture is quite different. And it's totally actually normal to have subcultures within a bigger culture who don't feel shame for certain reason or have insulated themselves from shame, or there's some sort of... So that's why I think that... And again, using the word shame here, I use it specifically instead of, let's say, exposure, which is the other word I toyed with, because exposure could mean for something good or for something bad. So exposing someone for something bad, to me, is shame. Like, there's not another great word for that. And maybe our semantics will come about, but right now I would argue there is a problem between sort of shame as both the verb and then as the emotion, the noun. And I try to tease them apart because I can show that even institutions, which we have to say they do not have feelings, they're not going to hide and they're not going to blush, they still exhibit changes in behavior on the basis of the threat of being exposed. And you point out about stock value, which is true for publicly traded corporations, and I would argue stock value can rebound, I mean, as we saw with BP after the Deepwater Horizon, then back up, right? But that, even those dips obviously make a company worried and make a publicly traded company more sensitive. But I guess that doesn't mean that everyone is impervious, because even companies that are very, very well insulated, that operate really far, like in commodities markets, like the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, still, this is not a good position for them to be in, because now they are getting divestment campaigns like The Guardian's or 350.org's across the U.S. who are saying, we don't want to work with this company, even if it's this far down the line. Mm-hmm. So I think that anytime you have reputation, you can have what I'm calling shame, the threat of social disapproval or the actual disapproval on the basis of a big campaign.
Jennifer, have you got a league table? I'm assuming it's easier for a pressure group to use this tactic than the government. So will Obama be in more trouble with his campaign against climate change deniers or not? And The Guardian, by the way, has extended its latest move on climate change is to ask the two really well-respected, you've probably seen,
yes,
the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Foundation here,
yeah,
to stop investing in oil and gas. So it seems to me that it's easier to turn the good intentions to behave even better than the people with bad intentions already.
And the lady...
Yeah. I'd appreciate it if we could explore, you would explore a little bit more this concept of honouring, because my worry in the area between shaming and honouring is that shaming has the potential for a lot of persecutory possibilities and social engineering. I'm just thinking, in fact, of that slide you put up of shaming the prostitutes. So in the wrong hands, and in this battle between forces of freedom and control at the moment, the use of it could be, well, highly social engineering and inflammatory, whereas honouring doesn't have persecutory. And so the whole consciousness of a society that honours as opposed to shame is an issue. It may not be as effective, but at a deeper level, it may be important for values and, you know, kindness.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I understand the desire to use, let's say, honour or reward, social reward, and I think it does create more positivity in society. But I would argue with things that I, you know, in the public, in evolutionary dynamics, would be called threshold public good games, where you have to have, let's say, 90% of people cooperating, otherwise everyone loses. And something like that in real life are immunizations. I don't think honor is ever going to get you where you need to go. And maybe shame won't either. Maybe it has to be mandatory. Maybe it has to be legislated. In the case of like some other examples where you might be able to, I would argue all these labels I put up are honoring labels. We're singling out these types of products as being better than every other product in the marketplace on some variable. But actually, one of the only cases I know of actually a shaming label, which as you can imagine is only capable of being produced by a government, because it is inevitably going to lead to losses. So there would be no private incentive for anyone to supply this, except if it was an NGO, essentially. There's no profit to be made in shaming. Was the Finnish government introduced a high salt label because they were having problems with the citizens eating too much salt, heart disease. So they said, we're going to start singling out products that have salt higher than X amount. And they're able to show that that label really made a difference. You know, as opposed to the U.S., we would definitely single out low-salt products. We would give them an honor label. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, especially when most products, let's say, are honorable in that respect, you don't wind up getting the behavioral results. So the only thing I'm encouraging here is to say, at what points do we want honor? For instance, the Academy Awards. You know, we don't need a shame awards for the worst movies made by industry. I would never advocate for something like that. It has no social impact. It doesn't affect all of us. It'd be a waste of our attention. We only want to know the best movies because we want to know which ones to see. We want to know the best doctors. We want to know the best music. All of this makes sense for a culture of honor to just take over, and really, and it has. I mean, there's this great book called The Economy of Prestige, if you're interested in the honor side of things. But I would say that in sort of social dilemmas and these collective risk dilemmas with high thresholds, honor really doesn't appear to be a tool that will provide any extra benefit above what we're already getting. But I completely agree that, I wouldn't hate to live in a world without honor, and I also think honor is the only appropriate tool in a lot of different other domains. And that kind of answers the question as well in terms of, I do think NGOs are in an often good place because also the credibility can be quite high and impervious to sort of partisan issues. Mm-hmm. But like that high salt label, there are some things where I think only the government is in position to actually do it, because guilt actually winds up being a friend of the market, because you can have this honor label that comes in and makes more money for the product. But if you're actually trying to single out companies or institutions, it's not a very profitable activity. And so sometimes it may be that also the government's particularly trustworthy. I know they have like the star system here for NHS, and I saw the hygiene ratings. Government seems in a better position to do those than, let's say, an NGO.
I'd like you to talk a little bit more about scale, because some of the experiences you put up there about the tuna campaign, for example, being a majority campaign, you know, it was a boycott leading to all tuna that you buy essentially now has a dolphin-safe label on it. And
partly talking about there must be differences in a PETA-type campaign against SeaWorld and a campaign of the scale and the consensus of the tuna campaign that's important in this whole discussion about shame, important for some of the points that have been made about the dangers of shaming campaigns coming from tiny groups. I mean, to turn it around, I saw a sign yesterday for 11-week-old fetuses outside Marie Stopes. I mean, you know, I doubt this group would be arguing with PETA, particularly on orcas, but, you know, you can easily imagine other situations where a tiny minorities group uses shaming very effectively against another minority population without any kind of control that doesn't actually get at what you're really talking about, mm-hmm. which is how do we cope as a society with our big issues where we need 90% consensus, where mm-hmm. we need to isolate the tiny minority that are really driving our biggest problems. So if you could address scale. And I guess I'd also just like to put in, I think we've got shaming labels for sure on cigarettes and alcohol. I mean, those are, as you are, to your point, they've come from government, and it's come from massive consensus, actually, about the need for that.
Cool. And the lead the back.
Thank you so much for spotting me at the back. I think the I've got a small comment about the Oscars and excellence, actually. I find that awards like that, they're rewarding a very particular kind of excellence, which I don't always appreciate. And I find that sometimes the films that are maybe, because there are competitions for the worst films, like the Razzies and Rotten Tomatoes, actually some of those films that score on that, they're different and they're individual, and I've actually found them quite rewarding. So I just thought I'd offer that as a comment. But my main question is this. As an environmental campaigner, I've come up again and again and again and again on the issue of people's consent and free will. And I'm wondering how shaming and personal guilt or public shaming fits into that. Because if we're using shaming as a mechanism to try and change behaviour, where should the boundaries of that sit?
Lovely. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll say that the whole free will argument, because I get it a lot too, probably even more than you do living in the U.S., so the freedom to choose, right, which is, thank you, Milton Friedman, forever and ever. You know, we don't let people choose so many things, and it's sort of silly. Like, I can't choose to take public transit in L.A. I actually don't have that freedom of choice. And I can't choose, for instance, as an individual, to put an end to the extinction of the Florida manatee, which I personally would really like to see. I can't drop out of school if I'm 12 years old. I can't smoke in certain restaurants. I mean, this whole idea, it's always just, that is the go-to argument if you're trying to make any sort of social restriction. But we have so many on the books already, so many that almost everyone enjoys, like, you know, requirements on which side of the road to drive, that it's, to me, it's just this absurd sort of, it's an absurd argument that I tend not to engage with very directly. You know, there are people that would say, let's say something like, I know Meatless Mondays in Germany, they tried to enact that in the government, right? And then they had that whole hands-off-my-sausage counter-campaign. And so they were saying that it was affecting their ability to choose meat. So, you know, I am not saying I don't think it comes up, but I think that the strategy just has to be sort of deal with it head-on and talk about all the things that we don't get to choose all the time. People in Bangladesh don't get to choose to eat meat. They don't eat any meat relative to, the Western world. So it's just, anyway. And then with regards to the sort of PETA, I want to just clarify that Blackfish was created by a totally independent filmmaker, and PETA took the campaign a little bit further, but it was really grassroots, really broad. So I think that mattered, actually. Like, had it just been them, it might have been a little more of an isolating campaign. But it was actually quite a broad voice. I mean, Outside Magazine did something, outlets that weren't very activist-oriented. But your point about is taken. The whole thing about shaming as opposed to, let's say, coercion or bullying, because people have said, well, doesn't the NRA, the National Rifle Association in the U.S., does it also do shaming? Like there was a new technology where you had to have a bracelet on to fire a gun. And they actually, members of the NRA or gun owners, certain ones, fought that in the media quite harshly. But then they also did call up the stores that were considering carrying those guns and threatened to kill the owners. So that takes it a step beyond. So to me, that's not shaming, obviously, but also...
But it's scaling up.
The whole... Well, yeah, exactly. Like, to me, that's kind of how, in my mind, I sort between... Because these words are being thrown around a lot online right now. Coercion, bullying, shaming... Mm. I view shaming as having wide support of the audience. And so if you don't have that, if it is just a very small group, that's more like bullying or coercion, right? If you don't have support of sort of... And that's the kind of hope for me about this and why I set it up that way, about the calling out the climate denialists in Congress, is because it is the first time in the last 8 years that the polls show that actually the majority of Republican voters support action on climate. So now that's why they're trying to broaden this sort of shaming campaign rather than, I think, focusing it on that coercion tactic you're talking about. But also in terms of scaling, some groups, I think, like Greenpeace, wind up having credibility across different countries because they don't take corporate money, and so they tend to be in a position in which they operate as the shamer more often than, like, WWF. And they manage to scale on certain issues better because they have this global presence. So I look for Amnesty International exact same way. It's kind of small, but it winds up having a lot of play around the world, so it seems positioned in a way that other NGOs that are really country-specific don't always have. Depends on the issue, though. Yeah. Shaming is a dangerous tool, and I'm in no way... It's a nuanced argument, but I think if you use with caution and aim well... it can wind up being a force for good in society.
Yeah, a necessary one.
And a necessary one. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.